History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we really need to hear. We do not want them to go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Henderson, Nevada, with a gentleman who's going to turn 100 years old in September, William Kendall, World War II Navy veteran. He was at somewhere pretty intense on June 6, 1944, but we're going to start before that. So, Mr. Kendall, you grew up in Boston with a brother and two sisters. What was that childhood like there?
Well, it was, I think, just ordinary. I had good brothers and sisters, and they took care of me. Both were older. I had a younger sister, and she and I were pals. So we had a good family group together. I don't think I'd expect anything better than that.
Do you remember, as that young boy, having some of those dreams that young boys sometimes have? When I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
I don't really know. And I heard people, like a friend of mine that came to the house was a ham, and I didn't understand what a ham was, but he kind of explained it to me, and he got me interested in the radio. That was about 9 years old.
So is that when you made your first crystal set?
That's when I made my first crystal. I was about 9 years old. Then I wound up with a one tuber, and I never got to be a learner of the code like I wanted to be, because it just wasn't in the cards at the time. But I think my life back, it's kind of all leads back to the guy that said he was a ham.
And you would have a long career as a radio and television engineer, but in order to do that, you had to survive World War II. And I'm interested in those times before World War II. You know, those of us alive today, we didn't live through the Great Depression. Yeah. Can you help us understand what that was like from your perspective?
Well, you know, you really don't understand what's happening to you at that particular time. When you look back at it, you say, see, things were tough, but you live through them. It's just like the weather in Boston, you know. We're all used to it, but we go back there now, we're crazy because we can't stand the humidity, for example. It's all relative. I dream of a lot of things that I did when I was a youngster because I have a pretty good memory of those days. It was a good life. I had good parents. But I was kind of a dummy in school. I wasn't very smart in school.
Were you a Boston Red Sox fan?
No, I was a Braves fan. No. My brother was a Red Sox fan. So we had a little competition there between the two.
Yeah, a lot of people today don't even know that the Braves were in Boston in those days.
And also the Redskins football team was in Boston. And I attended both of them.
You know, another thing we think of, Pearl Harbor in December 7th, and everybody has a memory of that. But I'm wondering for you, being in Boston on that Atlantic coast, if even before Pearl Harbor, was there a sense, an anxiety about U-boats in the Atlantic? And were you aware of some of what the Germans were doing out there?
We've read a lot of news in the paper about the war and things happening in Europe, and the Pacific was kind of a back page at the time, because it was all about Germany and the fighting in the Atlantic Ocean, and reading all about how the Germans invaded France and made the British go back to the Isles with their army that survived. That was all newspaper information at the time. And a little bit of radio. Radio wasn't so much in the news department as it is today.
And when did you start to figure out that you may end up becoming part of these military actions around the globe?
Well, I think when Pearl Harbor happened, we knew we were in it, and it was realizing we had a short time to be called up, and my call was about 4 months later. I got the notice from the draft board, and I talked to my brother, and he said, I tell you what I do, why don't we both go down and sign up? And he said he likes the Marines. They have wonderful looking uniforms. So we both went down to join the Marines, and they turned us both down because we were both underweight. I weighed 135 pounds, and I was 6'1", so it's kind of a lanky little guy. He decided not to join, and I joined the Navy instead because I didn't want to wind up in the Army.
And I know he became a paratrooper later on as well. What about December 7th? Do you remember that day? Do you remember where you were? How did you find out?
I was actually in the Citizen in Roebuck, and I heard the president. I think everybody was sort of expecting it anyway, but maybe not quite that soon. But we were still out of the war at the time.
So you and your brother both try to join the Marines. They turn you both down. He ends up as a paratrooper. You end up in the Navy. Did you have an idea of what you were going to do or what you wanted to do in the Navy?
Well, in boot camp, they gave us a choice of what we wanted to do after we finished training. And I put in, I'd like to be a gunner on a merchant marine. But I found out that they assigned me to the University of Chicago and the radio school. So they took my background and decided it for me. So I wound up going to 6 months to the University of Chicago and wound up finally learning the code.
There were some other things going on at the University of Chicago at that time. Isn't that where they were working on the Manhattan Project?
Apparently they were, but we didn't know what was going on.
Nobody did.
No.
Yeah. So they trained you in Morse code, in radio. Was that a challenge for you, or did it come naturally?
That came out pretty well. That was my good subject. So I wound up number 16th in my class of about 200. But I was very fortunate. The first 15 went to Navy training for aircraft, and they all wound up in PBYs, and a lot of them didn't make it. So I was shipped to Norfolk, Virginia, and wound up being assigned to the 2nd Beast Battalion.
Yeah, so you're saying that if you had been one spot higher in your class, you would have been sent in naval aviation flying on one of these seaplanes. And in your mind, that would have been a more dangerous duty for you?
Oh, yeah. I understood a lot of those students didn't survive the war. More than half of them, I understand.
And the only reason I seem a little puzzled by that is I know some of the places you were, and you made some landings where a lot of people were killed, at Sicily and at Normandy, and you ended up in the Pacific. So where did they send you from there, though, after that training was complete?
Well, I went to Norfolk, Virginia, and that's when they put us in the 2nd Beast Battalion. We then shipped out to North Africa, arrived in Oran during an air raid, incidentally. But we wound up in a field where the Army was located, and they sent out half a hopton to everybody in coveralls. We didn't know what was going on, and we found out we'd be good trained by the Army, and they did a pretty good job.
And some people listening probably have never heard of the 2nd Beach Battalion, so they may not understand what the role of a beach battalion is. Can you help us understand that bigger picture and also what your role in that unit was?
Well, our role was to land and set up the beaches for the assault troops. And we did that in Sicily and in Normandy.
And you had to establish some radio communications when you landed? Was that your specific role?
We had a little generator that came with us, and we had communications with the ships at sea. Of course, the whole thing was to get ashore and survive.
Yeah, and that was no small feat. And I know this is a long time ago, but you told me your memory is really sharp for those years. So I'm wondering if you remember just that journey over from Norfolk to North Africa. Was there some concern about German submarines or your convoy being attacked?
Well, I think there was some, as I understand, they were attacked. One of the ships was damaged, I understand, in the convoy. So I guess we did pretty good going across without being hit.
And did you have any thought in your mind as you're leaving the only country you've ever known and you're heading overseas, was there a concern in your mind that you might not come back?
No, I don't think so. It might have been, but I don't recall. I know the Army kind of brainwashed me, so you kind of lose the feeliness that goes with that I had prior to that. So things are a lot different when you're trained, particularly to do a thing. You do it automatically.
What was the first moment where it sank in for you that this is war, and you saw the side of war that includes death and destruction, and it's real?
Yeah, well, I know when we get ready to land in Sicily, we were put on an LST, which has small boats where we all loaded into, and then supposed to drop into the water. Well, the boat that I had me in went to the level of the ship deck and stopped, and the boat kind of swung out from the ship three or four times until someone found the trigger, and it dropped into the water about 10 feet. So, and as we hit, a couple of spotlights came in from the shore. We thought that was maybe the end of it. But they knocked that off, and we landed. And as we hit the beach, the ramp wouldn't go down because it was damaged during the hit against the side of the ship. So I was pretty well covered with it. I had a submachine gun and a lot of ammunition, so I couldn't get over the top like the other guys did. So I finally, the ramp got down about 25 inches maybe, and I squeezed through that. And I was kind of getting stuck in the V of the ship with my foot. Well, the guy put it in reverse and he threw me off. So I landed in the water about 3 or 4 feet.
This is your first landing, and this is Sicily. You know, we hear all this about D-Day, and now here's the 75th anniversary of D-Day, but not too many people know what you guys did at Sicily, which was a long time earlier. This is 1943. So I'm just trying to understand here. It kind of sounds like a nightmare.
It was a nightmare. That when we fell, it left my stomach, and we all threw up because we hit it so hard.
So you're in this landing craft, and you're swinging back and forth, crashing into the side of the ship, and then you finally drop and smack into the water. And so you're saying that jiggles you all up and disorients you?
We're maybe 3 or 4 minutes late getting going because of that. So we were the tail end of the group going in. But we all made it pretty well.
But then you're trying to get out of this boat, and the ramp is stuck.
Yeah,
and you say they just wedged it down enough where you could squeak through the opening between the ramp and the ship?
Just squeeze through.
And then you said your foot got caught. So then when the boat pulls back, you spill into the water. What did you see when you picked yourself up out of the water? What was going on around you?
Well, there was a lot of gunfire going on. It seems a lot of what they call the bullets you can see. We've been shot at pretty heavily as we're landing, but it seemed to be all above the boat. And when I actually landed, we saw the barbed wire on posts, and in our briefing, it didn't tell us anything about the barbed wire. But I met a couple of guys, and they had Bangalore torpedoes, which gives you about 16 feet of explosive, and they put them through the barbed wire and exploded, and we got away up through the beach. But it was a little hectic at the time, and we all survived. One of our group was shot by, I think he was shot by one of the Army guys. He's the only casualty I remember. It was a struggle to get there, but it was pretty good, and we settled down fairly fast.
I'm just imagining. I mean, you're a pretty young guy at this point.
23 years old, yeah.
You're old in relation to some of the other servicemen, but that's a young man to be going through all these things. How did you handle seeing those things, experiencing those things? Was your heart pounding? How did you respond to that?
No, I think I was so, you know, I always thought, I go back and say, why wasn't I scared? And I don't remember being scared. You know, usually you kind of panic when you went into that particular situation, but I didn't. I don't, it was because of the Army training. They took the fear right out of me, I guess. Because I was no brave fella. I was just one of the other guys that made the landing. And I saw a lot of the mayhem out there. We captured a few Italian soldiers. The part about that particular was they were all complaining that they had relatives in Chicago or New York City. Like I say, I survived it, so I was always called Lucky Billy, so that was part of my luck.
Lucky Billy made it out of there, but during the course of that six-week battle that followed, Operation Husky, they called it, to liberate Sicily, nearly 3,000 Americans were killed and more than 6,000 wounded. Some of the lessons of that landing would be applied the next year at Normandy, and our guest today, Bill Kendall, was involved in that as well. You can find photos of Bill then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this.